he's done. If he knows how to play the game, if he knows the variables, he'll sit in a corner for days, running through the possible moves, counter-moves, externalities, and outcomes. That's his idea of fun. Before Claudius's death, and before we were sent to live in different homes, he'd stay inside, rain or shine, and piece together puzzles, create mazes on paper, and beg me over and over again to try and find the center when I came back from riding with Father, or fishing with Claudius and Pax. And when I did find the center, he would laugh and say what a clever sister he had. I never thought much of it until I saw him afterward one day, alone in his room, when he thought no one was watching, shrieking and hitting himself in the face, punishing himself for losing to me. The next time he asked me to find the center of a maze, I pretended I couldn't, but he wasn't fooled. It was like he knew I'd seen him in his room. Not the introverted but pleasant, frail boy everyone else saw. The real him. She gathers her breath, shrugging away the thought. He made me finish the maze. And when I did, he smiled, said how clever I was, and walked off. The next time he drew a maze, I couldn't find the center, no matter how hard I tried. She shifts uncomfortably. He just watched me try from the floor among his pencils, like an old evil ghost inside a little porcelain doll. That's how I remember him. It's how I see him now when I think about him killing Father. The Telemannuses listen with a foreboding silence, as afraid of the jackal as I am. Darrow, he'll never forgive you for beating him at the Institute, for making him cut off his hand. He'll never forgive me for stripping him naked and delivering him to you. We are his obsession, just as much as Octavia is, as much as Father was. So if you think he's going to just forget how Severo waltzed into his citadel with a claw drill and stole you from under him, you're going to get a lot of people killed. Your plan to take the cities won't work. He'll see it coming a kilometer off. And even if he doesn't, if we take Mars, this war will last for years. We need to go for the jugular. And not just that, Daxo says. We need assurances that you're not aiming to begin a dictatorship, or a full democracy in the case of victory. A dictatorship? I ask with a smirk. You really think I want to rule? Daxo shrugs. Someone must. A woman clears her throat at the door. We wheel around to see Holliday standing there with her thumbs in her belt loop. Sorry to interrupt, sir, but the Bologna is asking for you. It seems rather important. Chapter 37 The Last Eagle. Cassius lies handcuffed to the rails of the reinforced medical gurney in the center of the Sons of Ares infirmary. The same place I watched my people die from the wounds they suffered to save me from his clutches. Bed after bed of injured rebels from Phobos and other operations on the thermic fill the expanse. Ventilators whir and beep. Men cough. But it's the weight of the eyes that I feel most. Hands reach for me as I pass through the rows of cots and pallets lying on the floor. Mouths whisper my name. They want to touch my arms, to feel a human without sigils, without the mark of the masters. I let them as well as I can, but I haven't time to visit the fringes of the room. I asked Dancer to give Cassius a private room. Instead, he's been set smack in the middle of the main infirmary, among the amputees, adjacent to the huge plastic tent that covers the burn unit. There he can watch and be watched by the low colors, and feel the weight of this war the same way they do. I sense Dancer's hand at work here, giving Cassius equitable treatment. No cruelty, no consideration, just the same as the rest. I feel like buying the old socialist a drink. Several of Nero's boys, a grey and two weathered ex-hell divers, slump on metal chairs playing cards near Cassius's bedside. Heavy scorchers slung around their backs. They jump to their feet and salute as I approach. "Heard he's been asking for me," I say. "Most the night," the shorter of the Reds answers gruffly, eyeing Holiday behind me. "Wouldn't have bothered you, but he's a bloody damn Olympic, so thought we should pass the word up the chain." He leans so close I can smell the menthol of the synth tobacco between his stained teeth. "And the slagger says he's got information, sir."
"Can he talk?"
"Yeah," the soldier grumbles. "Doesn't say much, but the boat's missed his box." "I need to speak with him privately," I say. "We got you covered, sir."
The doctor and the guards wheel Cassius's gurney to the far back of the room, to the pharmacy, which they keep guarded under lock and key. Inside, among the rows of plastic medication boxes, Cassius and I are left alone. He watches me from his bed, a white bandage around his neck, the faintest pinprick of blood dilating between his Adam's apple and the jugular on the right side of his throat.
"It's a miracle you're not dead," I say.
He shrugs. There's no tubes in his arms or morphine bracelet.
I frown.
"They didn't give you painkillers?"
"Not punishment. They voted."
He says very slowly, taking care not to rip the stitches on his neck.
"Wasn't enough morphon to go around. Low supplies. As they tell, the patients voted last week to give the hard meds to the burn victims and amputees. I'd think it noble if they didn't moan all night from pain, like lonely little puppies."
He pauses.
"I always wondered if mothers can hear their children weeping for them."
"Can yours?"
"I didn't weep. And I don't think my mother cares much for anything other than revenge. Whatever that means at this point."
"You said you had information," I ask. To business, because I don't know what else to say. I feel an ironclad kinship with this man. Severo asked why I saved him, and I could aspire to notions of valor and honor. But the deep spine reason is, I desperately want him to be a friend again. I crave his approval. Does that make me a fool? Disloyal? Is it the guilt speaking? Is it his magnetism? Or is it that vain part of me that just wants to be loved by the people I respect? And I do respect him. He has honor, a corrupted sort, but true honor nonetheless.
"Was it her, or was it you?"
he asks carefully.
"What do you mean?" "Who kept the obsidians from boiling out my eyes and taking my tongue, you or Virginia?"
"It was both of us."
"Liar. Didn't think she'd shoot, to tell the truth of it."
He reaches up to feel his neck, but the manacles jerk his hands to a halt, startling him back into the room.
"Don't suppose you could take these off. It's dreadful when you've got an itch."
"I think you'll live." He chuckles as if saying he had to try.
"So, is this where you act morally superior for saving me?
for being more civilized than gold? Maybe I'm going to torture you for information, I say.
Well, that's not exactly honorable.
Neither is letting a man put me in a box for 9 months after torturing me for 3. Anyway, what the hell ever made you think I'd give a shit about being honorable?
True.
He frowns, creasing his brow, and looking startling, like something Michelangelo would have carved.
If you think the sovereign will barter, you're wrong. She won't sacrifice a single thing to save me.
Then why serve her? I ask.
Duty.
He says the words, but I wonder how deeply he means them any longer. In his eyes I glimpse the loneliness, the longing for a life that should have been, and the glimmer of the man he wants to be underneath the man he thinks he has to be. All the same, I say, I think we've done enough evil to one another. I'm not going to torture you. Do you have information, or are we just going to dance around it for another 10 minutes?
Have you wondered yet why the sovereign was suing for peace, Darrow? Surely it must have crossed your mind. She's not one to dilute punishment unless she must. Why would she show leniency to Virginia, to the Rim? Her fleets outnumber those of the Moon Lord rebels 3-1. The Corps is better supplied. Romulus can't match Roke. You know how good he is. So why would the Sovereign send us to negotiate? Why compromise?
I already know she wanted to replace the Jackal, I say. And she can't very well have a full-scale rebellion on the Rim while trying to cuff his ears and fight the Sons of Ares. She's trying to limit her theaters of war so she can focus all her weight on one problem at a time. It's not a complicated strategy.
But do you know why she wanted to remove him?
My escape, the camps, the disruptions in helium processing. I could list 100 reasons why installing a psychopath as arch-governor could prove burdensome.
All those are valid, he says, interrupting. Convincing, even. And they are the reasons we provided Virginia.
I step back toward him, hearing the implication in his voice. What didn't you tell her? He hesitates, as if wondering even now if he should tell me. Eventually, he does.
Earlier this year, our intelligence agents discovered discrepancies between the quarterly helium production logs reported to the Department of Energy and the Department of Mine Management, and the yield reports from our agents in mining colonies themselves. We found at least 125 instances where the Jackal falsely reported helium losses due to Sons of Ares disruption. Disruptions which didn't exist. He also claimed 14 mines destroyed by Sons of Ares attacks. Attacks which never happened.
So, he's skimming off the top, I say with a shrug. Hardly the first corrupt arch-governor in the world.
But he's not reselling it on the market,
Cassius says.
He's creating artificial shortages while he stockpiles.
Stockpiles? How much so far? I ask tensely.
With the surplus inventory from the 14 mines and the Martian reserve? At this rate, in 2 years he'll have more than the Imperial reserves on Luna and Venus and the war reserve on Ceres combined.
That could mean 100 things, I say quietly, realizing just how much fuel that is. 3/4 of the most valuable substance in the world, all under the control of one man. He's making a play for Sovereign. Buying senators?
40 so far, Cassius admits. More than we thought he had. But there's another kink which he's involved them in.
He tries to sit up straighter in his cot, but the manacles around his hands anchor him to a half-slouched pose.
I'm going to ask you a question, and I need you to tell me the truth.
I'd laugh at the idea if I didn't see how serious he is.
Did the Sons of Ares rob a deep space asteroid warehouse in March, several days after your escape?
About 4 months ago. Be more specific, I say.
A minor main belter in the Karin cluster, designation S1988, silicate-based junk asteroid, nearly zero mining potential. Specific enough?
I reviewed the entirety of Severo's tactical operations when I was making my recovery with Mickey. There were several assaults on Legion military bases within the asteroid belts, but nothing remotely like what Cassius is talking about.
No, there were no operations on S1988 that I know of. Gory damn,
he mutters under his breath.
Then we judged right.
What was in the warehouse? I ask. Cassius?
500 nuclear warheads,
he says darkly. The blood on his bandage has spread to the size of a gaping mouth.
500, I echo, my own voice a distant, hollow thing.
What was their yield?
30 megatons each.
World killers.
Cassius, why would they even exist? In case the Ash Lord ever had to repeat Rhea,
Cassius says.
The depot lies between the core and the rim.
Repeat Rhea?
That's who you serve,
I ask. A woman who stores enough nuclear warheads to destroy a planet, just in case? He ignores my tone.
All evidence pointed to Ares, but the Sovereign thought it gave Severo too much credit. She had Moira investigated personally, and she was able to trace the tags of the hijacker's ship to a defunct shipping line formerly owned by Julii Industries.
If the Sons truly didn't steal them, then the Jackal has the weapons.
But we don't know what he's doing with them.
I stand there, numb, mind racing to piece together how the Jackal might utilize so many atomics. According to the compact, the Martian military is only permitted 20 in its arsenal for ship-to-ship warfare, all under 5 megatons. If this is true, why would you tell me? I ask.
Because Mars is my home too, Darrow. My family has been there as long as yours. My mother is still there, in our home. Whatever the Jackal's long-term strategy is, the judgment of the Sovereign is that he will use the weapons here if his back is to the wall.
You're afraid we might win, I realize.
When it was Severo's war, no. The Sons of Ares was doomed. But now? Look what's happening.
He looks me up and down.
We've lost containment. Octavia doesn't know where I am, whether or not Aja is alive. She has no eyes on this. The Jackal might know she tried to betray him to his sister. He's a wild dog. If you provoke him, he will bite.
He lowers his voice.
You might be able to survive that, Darrow. But can Mars?
Chapter 38. The Bill.
500 nuclear warheads. Several whispers. Holy bloody damn shit. Tell me you're joking. Go on.
Dancer sits quietly at the war room table, kneading his temples.
It's bullshit,
Holiday grunts from the wall.
If he has them, he'd have used them.
Let's leave the deductions to the individuals who have actually met the man, shall we? Victor says. Adrius doesn't function like a normal human.
That's for damn sure,
Severo says. Still, that's a solid question, Dancer says, annoyed at the presence of so many golds, particularly Mustang, who stands beside me. If he has them, why hasn't he used them? Because that sort of escalation will hurt him almost as much as it hurts us, I say. And if he uses them, the Sovereign will have every excuse to replace him.
Oh, he doesn't have them,
Quicksilver says dismissively. He floats before us, blue holopixels shimmering over a display panel.
It's a ploy. Bologna knows what you care about, Darrow. He's plucking your heartstrings with notions of oblivion. It's bullshit. My techs would have seen major ripples if he was moving missiles, and I would have heard about plutonium enriching if the Sovereign had built them.
Unless they're old missiles, I say. Lots of relics lying about.
And it's a big solar system, Mustang says evenly.
I've got big ears,
Quicksilver replies.
Had, Victor says. They're whittling them down as we speak.
The leaders of the rebellion sit in a semicircle in front of a holoprojector, which displays asteroid S1988. It's a barren hunk of rock, part of the Charon subfamily of the Coronas family of asteroids in the main belt between Mars and Jupiter. The Coronas asteroids are the base for heavy mining operations by an Earth-run energy consortium, and home to several disreputable astral way stations for smugglers and pirates, most notably 208 Lacrimosa, where Severo refueled on his journey from Pluto to Mars. The locals call the smuggler's cove Our Lady of Sorrows, where life is cheaper than a kilo of iced helium and a gram of demon dust, or so he says. He's unusually quiet about the place, and his time there. Gold war room meetings are held in circles or rectangles because people facing one another are more likely to engage in intellectual conflict than people sitting side by side. Golds relish that. I'm trying a different tack, having my friends face the problem, the holoprojector, so if they want to argue with one another, they have to crane their necks to do it.
It's a shame we don't have the Sovereign's oracles, Mustang says. Strap one on his wrist and see how forthcoming Cassius really is.
Sorry we don't quite have the resources you're used to, Domina,
Dancer says.
That's not what I meant.
We could torture him,
Severo says. He's in the middle of the table, cleaning his fingernails with a blade. Victra leans against the wall behind him, flinching in annoyance with each flake of nail that falls onto the table. Dancer is to Severo's left. The meter-tall hologram of Quicksilver glows to his right, between us. Having declared Phobos a free city on behalf of the Rising, he functions as its governor, and now hunches over a small stack of thumb-sized heart oysters with a platinum octopus shucking knife, arranging the shells in five even mounds. If he's nervous about the Jackal's reprisals against his station, he doesn't look it. Sephi sweats underneath her tribal furs as she stalks along the perimeter of the table like a trapped animal, making Dancer shift in agitation.
You want the truth? Severo asks. Just give me 17 minutes and a screwdriver.
Should we really be having this talk with her here?
Victor asks of Mustang.
She's on our side, I say. Are you sure?
Dancer asks.
She was crucial to recruiting the Obsidians, I say. She's connected us with Orion.
I made contact with the woman after speaking with Cassius. She's burning hard with the Pax and a sizable remnant of my old fleet to meet me. Seems impossible I'd ever see the ornery blue again, or that ship which was the first place to feel like home since Lycos. Because of Mustang, we'll have a real navy. She preserved my command. She kept Orion at the helm. Would she have done that if she didn't have the same aims as us? Which are? Dancer asks. Defeating Loon and the Jackal, she says.
That's just the surface of what we want, Dancer says.
She's working with us, I stress. For now, Victor says. She's a clever girl. Maybe she wants to use us to eliminate her enemies, place herself in a position of power. Maybe she wants Mars. Maybe she wants more.
Seems only yesterday my Council of Golds was discussing whether or not Victra was worth trusting. Roke spoke up for her when no one else would.
The irony is apparently lost on Victra. Or maybe she remembers Mustang's vocal distrust of her intentions a year ago, and has decided to repay the old debt.
I hate to agree with the Julii, Dancer says, but she's right in this. Augustans are players. Not one's been born that hasn't been.
Apparently Dancer wasn't impressed with Mustang's lack of transparency earlier. Mustang expected this. In fact, she asked to stay in her room, away from this, so she wouldn't detract from my plan. But in order for this to work, in order for there to be some way to piece things together in the end, there must be cooperation. They expect me to defend Mustang, which shows how little they know her.
You are all being rather illogical, Mustang says. I don't mean that as an insult, but simply as a statement of fact. If I meant you ill, I would have hailed the Sovereign or my brother and brought a tracking device on my ship. You know what lengths she would go to in order to find Tinos.
My friends exchanged troubled glances.
But I didn't. I know you will not trust me, but you trust Darrow, and he trusts me. And since he knows me better than any of you do, I think he's in the best position to make the call. So stop whimpering like gory-damn children, and let's be about the task, eh?
If you have a buzzsaw, I could do it in around 3 minutes, Severo says.
Will you shut the hell up?
Dancer barks at him. It's the first time I've ever seen him lose his temper.
A man will lie through his teeth, say whatever you want to hear if you're pulling off his toenails. It doesn't work.
He was tortured himself by the Jackal, just like Evie and Harmony were. Severo crosses his arms.
Well, that's an unfair and massive generalization, Gramps. We don't torture, Dancer says. That's final.
Oh, yeah, right, Severo says. We're the good guys. Good guys never torture, and always win.
But how many good guys get their heads put in boxes? How many get to watch their friends' spines cut in half?
Dancer looks to me for help.
Darrow.
Quicksilver pops open an oyster.
Torture can be effective, if done correctly, with confirmable information in a narrow scope. Like any tool, it is not a panacea. It must be used properly. Personally, I don't really think we have the luxury of drawing moral lines in the sand. Not today. Let Barker have a go. Pull some nails. Some eyes, if need be.
I agree,
Theodora says, surprising the council.
What about Mateo?
I ask Quicksilver.
Severo shattered his face.
Quicksilver's knife slips on the new oyster, punching into the meat of his palm. He winces and sucks at the blood.
And if he hadn't have passed out, he would have told you where I was. From my experience, pain is the best negotiator.
I agree with them, Darrow, Mustang says. We have to be certain he's telling the truth.
Otherwise, we're letting him dictate our strategy, which is classic counterintelligence on his part. It's what you would do.
And it's what I tried to do till the torture started with the jackal.
Victor, who has been silent on the issue till now, walks abruptly around the table into the hollow projection, so that black space and stars play along her skin. Jagged, white-blonde hair drifts in front of angry eyes as she pulls her grey shirt off. She's muscled and lithe beneath, and wears a compression bra. A half-dozen razor scars stretch 3 inches at a diagonal across her flat belly. There's more than a dozen on her sword arm, a few on her face, neck, clavicle.
"Some I'm proud of," she says of the scars. "Some I'm not."
She turns to show us her lower back.
It's a waxy, melted swath of flesh where her sister left her mark in acid.
She turns back to us, raising her chin in defiance.
"I came here because I didn't have a choice. I stayed when I did. Don't make me regret that."
It's startling to see the vulnerability in her. I don't think Mustang would ever let her guard down in public like this. Severo stares intensely at the tall woman as she tugs her shirt back on and turns back to the hollow. She reaches for the asteroid with both hands to stretch the hologram.
"Can we get better resolution?"
she asks, as if the matter is settled.
"The picture was taken by a Census Bureau drone," I say, "nearly 70 years ago. We don't have access to the current society military records."
"My men are on it," Quicksilver says. "But they're not optimistic. We're fighting a legion of society counterattacks right now. Gory damn maelstrom."
"This is when having your father around would come in handy,"
Severo says to Mustang.
"He never mentioned anything like this to me," she replies.
"Mother did once,"
Victor says thoughtfully.
"Antonia and I. Something about nasty little goodie bags that imperators could collect on the fly if the rim went off the tracks."
That matches with what Cassia says. She turns back to us.
"I think Cassius is telling the truth."
"So do I," I say to the group. "And torturing him doesn't resolve anything. Cut off his fingers one by one, and what if he still says it's true? Do we keep cutting until he says it's not? Either way, it's a gamble."
I get a few reluctant nods and feel relief that at least one battle's won, if a little wary knowing how savage my friends can become.
"What did he suggest we do?"
Dancer asks.
"I'm sure he had a proposal."
"He wants me to have a holo conference with the Sovereign," I say.
"Why?"
"To discuss an alliance against the Jackal. They give us intel, we kill him before he can detonate any bombs," I say. "That's his plan."
Severo giggles.
"Sorry, but that would be bloody damn fun to watch." He pulls up his left hand and makes a talking motion with it.
"Hello, you old rusty bitch. You recall when I kidnapped your grandchild?"
He pulls up his right hand.
"Why, yes, my goodman, just after I enslaved your entire race."
He shakes his head.
"No purpose in talking to that pixie. Not until we're knocking on her doorstep with a fleet. You should send me and the Howlers after good old Jackal. Can't press a button without a head."
"The Valkyrie will attend this mission with the Howlers,"
Seffi says. "No, the Jackal will invite a personal attack," I say, glancing at Mustang, who has already warned me off that course. "He knows us too well to be surprised by things we've done in the past. I'm not throwing lives away by playing into his understanding of our strengths."
"Do you have anyone inside his inner circle, Regulus?"
Dancer asks Quicksilver. Surprisingly, the two men seem to rather like one another.
I did, until your greys broke Darrow out. Adrius had his chief of intelligence purge his inner circle. My men are all dead, or imprisoned, or scared shitless.
What do you think, Augustus?
Dancer asks Mustang.
All eyes turn to her. She takes her time in replying.
I think the reason you've managed to stay alive so long is because Goals are so consumed with the individual ego that they've forgotten how they conquered Earth. Each thinks they can rule. With Orion returning and Severo's gains, your greatest strength now lies with your navy and an obsidian army. Don't help the Sovereign. She is still the most dangerous enemy. You help her, she focuses on you. Sow more seeds of discord.
Dancer nods in agreement. But are we sure the Jackal would actually use the nukes on the planet?
The only thing my brother ever wanted was my father's approval. He did not get it. So he killed my father. Now he wants Mars. What do you think he'll do if he doesn't get it?
A menacing silence fills the room. I have a new plan, I say.
I should bloody damn hope so, Severo mutters to Victra. Do I get to hide inside anything? I'm sure we can find something for you, darling, she says.
I nod my agreement. He waves a hand.
Well, then let's hear it, Reaper.
Hypothetically, assume we can take half the cities of Mars, I say, standing and summoning a graphic from the table that shows a red tide flowing over the globe of Mars, claiming cities, pushing back the Goals. Say we crush the Jackal's fleet in orbit when Orion joins us, even though we are outnumbered 2-1. Say we shatter his armies. With the Valkyrie's help, we fracture the Obsidians away from the Legions and have them join us. And we have a groundswell from the populace itself. The machines of industry grind to a complete halt on Mars. We've rebuffed the society's countless reinforcements, and we have insurrection in every street, and we have cornered the Jackal after years of warfare. And it will take years. What happens then?
The machines of industry don't stop off of Mars, Victra says. They keep rolling, and they'll keep pumping men and material here.
Or, I say, he uses the bombs, Dancer says, which I also believe he'll use on the Obsidians and our army if we go ahead with Operation Rising Tide, I say. We've been prepping the operation for months, Dancer protests. With the Obsidians, it might just work. You want to scrap it? Yes, I say. This planet is why we fight. The strength of rebel armies throughout history is that they have less to protect. They can rove and move and are impossible to pin down. We have so much to lose here, so much to protect. This war won't be won in days or weeks. It will be a decade. Mars will bleed, and at the end, ask yourselves, what will we inherit? A corpse of what was once our home. We must fight this war, but I will not fight it here. I propose we leave Mars.
Quicksilver coughs.
Leave Mars?
Sephi steps forward from the shadows of the stone room.
You said you would protect my people.
Our strength is here, in the tunnels, Dancer continues. In our population. That's where our responsibility lies, Darrow.
He glances at Mustang, his suspicions clear.
Don't forget where you come from, why you're doing this.
I have not forgotten, Dancer.
Are you so sure? This war is for Mars.
It's for more than that, I say.
For low colors,
he continues, voice gaining volume, Win here, and then spread across the society. It's where the helium is. It is the heart of the society, of Red. Win here, then spread. That's how Ares intended it. This war is for everyone, Mustang corrects.
No,
Dancer says territorially. This is our war, Gold. I was fighting it when you were still learning how to enslave human beings at your... Severo looks at me in annoyance as our friends descend into bickering. I give him a little nod, and he pulls his razor and slams it into the table. It cuts halfway through and trembles there.
Reapers trying to speak, you shit gobblers! Besides, all this colorism bores me.
He looks around, terribly pleased with the silence. He nods to himself and waves a theatrical hand.
Reaper, please, continue. You are getting to the exciting part.
Thank you, Severo. I won't fall into the trap of the jackal, I say. The easiest way to lose any war is to let the enemy dictate the terms of engagement. We must do the thing the jackal and the sovereign least expect of us. Create our own paradigm so they're playing our game, reacting to our decisions. We must be bold. Right now, we've sparked a fire. Rebellions in almost all society territories. We stay here, that means we are contained. I will not be contained. I transfer the image on my datapad to the table so that the hologram of Jupiter floats in the air. 63 tiny moons dot the periphery, but the 4 great Jovian moons dominate its orbit. These 4 largest, Ganymede, Callisto, Io, and Europa, are referred to collectively as Ilium. Around those moons are 2 of the largest fleets in the solar system, that of the Moon Lords and that of the Sword Armada. Severo looks so pleased he might faint. I'm giving him the war he didn't even know he wanted. The civil war between Bellona and Augustus has exposed larger fault lines between the core and the outer rim. Octavia's main fleet, the Sword Armada, is hundreds of millions of kilometers away from its nearest support. Excepting the Scepter Armada around Luna, it is the greatest weapon Octavia has. Octavia sent our good friend Roque Ao Fabii to bring the Moon Lords to heel. He has shattered every fleet that has been thrown against them. Even with the help of Mustang, the Telemannuses, and the Arcoses, he has beaten the Rim down. On board these ships are more than 2 million men and women, more than 10,000 Obsidian, 200,000 Greys, 3,000 of the greatest killers alive, Peerless Scarred, Praetors, Legates, Knights, Squad Commanders, the greatest golds of their institutes. This fleet has been reinforced by Antonia Aus Severus Julii, and it is the instrument of fear by which the Sovereign binds the planets to her will. It, like its commander, has never been defeated. I pause, allowing the words to sink in so they all know the gravity of my proposal. In 40 days, we're going to destroy the Sword Armada and rip the beating heart out of the society war machine. I pull Severo's razor out of the table and toss it back to him. Now, I'll take your bloody damn questions.
Chapter 39 The Heart.
Dancer finds me as I make final preparations to board the shuttle with Severo and Mustang that will lead us to the fleet in orbit. Tinos swarms with activity. Hundreds of shuttles and transports gathered by Dancer and his Sons of Ares leadership depart through the great tunnels to make their migration toward the South Pole, where they will still ferry the Obsidian young and old from their home to the safety of the mines. But the warriors will go to orbit to join my fleet. In 24 hours they will move 800,000 human beings in the greatest effort in Sons of Ares history. It makes me smile thinking how much happier Fitchner would be, knowing the greatest endeavor of his legacy was to save lives instead of to take them. After covering the evacuation with the fleet, I will burn hard for Jupiter. Dancer and Quicksilver will remain behind to continue what they started and hold the Jackal on Mars till the next evolution of the plan begins. It's haunting, isn't it? Dancer says, watching the sea of blue engine flares that flow past our stalactite up to the great tunnel in the ceiling of Tinos. Victra stands closely with Severo at the edge of the open hangar, two dark silhouettes watching the hope of two peoples float away into the darkness. The Red Armada goes to war. Dancer breathes. Never thought I'd see the day. Fitchner should be here, I reply. Yes, he should, Dancer grimaces. It's my greatest regret, I think. That he couldn't live to see his son wear his helm. And you become what he always knew you to be. And what's that? I ask, watching a red howler jump twice with his grav boots and rocket off the edge of the hangar to enter the open cargo hatch of a passing troop carrier. Someone who believes in the people, he says delicately. I turn to face Dancer. Glad that he sought me out in my last moments here among my kin. I don't know if I'll ever return. And if I do, I fear he will see me as a different man. One who betrayed him, our people, Io's dream. I've been here before, saying goodbye on a landing pad. Harmony stood with him then. Mickey, too, as they said goodbye on that spire in Yorkton. How can I feel so melancholy for so terrible a past? Maybe that's just the nature of us, ever wishing for things that were and could be, rather than things that are and will be. It takes more to hope than to remember. Do you think the Moon Lords will really help us? He asks. No. The trick will be making them think they're helping themselves, then getting out before they turn on us. It's a risk, boy. But you like those, don't you? I shrug. It's also the only chance we have. Boots clomp on the metal deck behind me. Holiday moves past, up the ramp, carrying a bag of gear with several new howlers. Life moves on, carrying me with it. It's been nearly 7 years since Dancer and I met. Yet it seems 30 on him. How many decades of war has he faced? How many friends has he said goodbye to that I've never known, that he's never even mentioned? People who he loved as much as I love Severo and Ragnar. He had a family once, though he rarely speaks of them now. We all had something once. We're each robbed and broken in our own way. That's why Fitchner formed this army. Not to piece us together, but to save himself from the abyss his wife's death opened in him. He needed a light, and he made it. Love was his shout into the wind. Same with my wife. Lorne once told me, if he had been my father, he would have raised me to be a good man. There's no peace for great men, he said. I smile at the memory. I should have asked him who he thinks makes the peace for all those good men. You are a good man, Dancer tells me. My hands are scarred and brutal things. When I clench them, their knuckles turn that familiar shade of white. Yeah, I grin. Then why do I want to do bad things? He laughs at that, and I surprise him by pulling him into a hug. His good arm wraps around my hips, his head barely coming to my chest. Severo might have worn the helmet, but you're the heart here, I tell him. You always have been. You're too humble to see it, but you're as great a man as Ares himself. And somehow you're still good, Unlike that dirty rat bastard. I pull back and thump his chest. And I love you. Just so you know.
Oh, bloody damn. He mutters, eyes tearing up. I thought you were a killer.
You gone soft on me, boy?
Never,
I say, winking. He pushes me off.
Go say goodbye to your mother before you go.
I leave him to shout at a group of Sun's Marines, and work my way through the bustle, bumping fists with Pebble, whose screwface pushes on a wheelchair toward a boarding ramp, tossing a salute to Sons of Ares I recognize, talking shit back to Uncle Nerol, who walks with a troop of pit vipers. They're destined for a sabotage mission against the Jackal's deep space communication relays. My mother and Mustang stop talking abruptly when I arrive. Both look distraught. What's the matter? I ask.
Just saying goodbye,
Mustang says. My mother steps close to me.
Dio brought this from Lycos.
She opens a little plastic box and shows me the dirt inside.
My little mother smiles up at me. You fly into night, and when all grows dark, remember who you are. Remember, you are never alone. The hopes and dreams of our people go with you. Remember home.
She pulls me down to kiss my forehead.
Remember you are loved.
I hug her tight and pull back to see she has tears in her hard eyes.
I'll be all right, Ma, I say.
I know.
I know you don't think you deserve to be happy, she says.
But you do, child. You deserve it more than anyone I know.
So do what you need to do, then come home to me.
She takes my hand, and Mustang's. Both of you, come home. Then start living. I leave her behind, confused and emotional.
What was that about?
I ask Mustang. Mustang looks at me as if I should know.
She's afraid.
Why?
She's your mother.
I walk up my shuttle's landing pad with Severo and Victra, who join Mustang and I at the bottom.
Hell diver!
Dancer shouts before we reach the top. I turn back to find the gnarled man with his fist thrust in the air, and behind him the whole of the stalactite hangar watches me, hundreds of deckhands on mechanized loading trams, pilots, blue and red and green, who stand at the ramps of their ships, or on the ladders leading into their cockpits, helmets in hands, platoons of greys and reds and obsidians standing side by side, carrying combat gear and supplies, the scythe sewn onto shoulders, painted onto faces, as they board shuttles bound for my fleet. Men and women of Mars all, fighting for something larger than themselves, for our planet. For their people. I feel the weight of their love. I feel the hopes of all those people in bondage who watched as the Sons of Ares rose to take Phobos. We promised them something, and now we must deliver. One by one, my army raises their hands till a sea of fists clench, as Eos did when she held the Himanthus and fell before Augustus. Chills run through me as Severo and Victra and Mustang and even my mother raise their hands in union.
Break the chains!
Dancer bellows. I raise my own scarred fist and step silently into the shuttle to join the Red Armada as it sails to war. Chapter 40 Yellow Sea. The yellow sea of Io rolls in around my black boot. Great dunes of sulfur-laced sand with razorback ridges of silicate rock as far as the eye can see. In the steel-blue sky, the marbled surface of Jupiter undulates, 130 times the diameter that Luna appears from the surface of Earth, it seems the vast and evil head of a marble god. War grips its 67 moons. Cities hunker under pulse shields. Blackened husks of men in star shells litter moons, while fighter squadrons duel and hunt troop and supply transports among the faint ice rings of the gas giant. It's quite a sight. I stand upon the dune, flanked by Sephi and 5 Valkyrie in black pulse armor, waiting for the Moon Lord's shuttle. Our assault ship sits behind us, engines idling. It's shaped like a hammerhead shark, dark gray. But the Valkyrie and red dockworkers painted its head together on our journey from Mars, giving the ship 2 bulging blue eyes and a gaping mouth with ravenous blood-stained teeth. Up between the eyes, Holiday lies on her belly, sniper rifles scanning the rock formations to the south. "Anything?" I ask, voice crackling through the breathing mask. "Nothing," Severo says over the comm. He and Clown scout the little settlement 2 clicks away on grav boots. I can't see them with the naked eye. I fidget with my sling blade. "They'll come," I say. "Mustang set the time and place." Io is a strange moon. Innermost and smallest of the 4 great Galilean moons, she is a belt notch larger than Luna. It was never her destiny to be fully changed by the gold's terraforming machines. She's a hell Dante could be proud of. The driest object in the Sol system, rife with explosive volcanism and sulfur deposits and interior tidal heating. Her surface a canvas of yellow and orange plains, broken by huge thrust faults from her shifting surface. Dramatic sheer cliffs rising from the sulfur dunes to scrape the sky. Huge stains of concentric green freckle her equatorial regions. Finding crops and animals difficult to cultivate so far from the sun, the Society Engineering Corps covered millions of acres of Io surface with pulse fields, imported dirt and water for 3 lifetimes on Cosmos haulers, thickened the planet's atmosphere to filter Jupiter's massive radiation, and used the planet's interior tidal heating to power great generators to grow foodstuffs for the entire Jupiter orbit and exportation to the core and, more importantly, the rim. She's a farm deck, with the biggest breadbasket between Mars and Uranus, with easy gravity and cheap land. Guess who did all the labor? Beyond the pulse fields is the sulfur sea, stretching from pole to pole, interrupted only by volcanoes and lakes of magma. I may not like Io, but I can respect the people of this land. Ionian men and women are not like humans of Earth or Luna or Mercury or Venus. They are harder, lither, eyes slightly larger to absorb the dimmed light 600 million kilometers from the sun, skin pale, taller, and able to withstand higher doses of radiation. These people believe themselves most like the Iron Golds who conquered Earth and put man at peace for the first time in her history. I shouldn't have worn black today. My gloves, my cloak, my jacket underneath. I thought we were going to the anti-Jupiter side of Io, where sulfur dioxide snowfields crust the planet. But the Moon Lord's operation team demanded a new meeting point at the last moment, setting us on the edge of the sulfur sea. Temperature, 120 degrees Celsius. Sephi walks up to stand beside me with her new optics scanning the yellow horizon. She and her Valkyrie have taken quickly to the gear of war, studying and training day and night with Holiday during our month and a half journey to Jupiter, practicing shipboarding and energy weapon tactics, as well as gray hand signals. "How's the heat?" I ask. "Strange," she says. Only her face can feel it. The rest benefits from the cooling systems and the armor. "Why would people live here?" "We live everywhere we can.
But gold's choose, she says. Yes?
Yes.
I would be wary, men who choose such a home. The spirits here are cruel.
Sand kicks up from the wind and the low gravity, floating down in wavering columns. It's Sephi who Mustang thinks I should be wary of. On our journey to Jupiter, she has watched hundreds of hours of holo footage, learning our history as a people. I keep track of her datapad's activity. But what concerns Mustang isn't that Sephi is fond of rainforest videos and experientials, but that she has spent countless hours watching holos of our wars, particularly the nuclear annihilation of Rhea. I wonder what she makes of it.
Sound advice, Sephi, I reply. Sound advice.
Severo lands dramatically before us, spraying us with sand. His ghost cloak ripples away.
Bloody damn shithole!
I dust off my face, annoyed. He was incorrigible the whole journey out here, laughing, pulling pranks, and slipping off to Victra's room whenever he thought no one was looking. Ugly little man's in love. And for what it's worth, it seems to go both ways.
What do you think? I ask. The whole place smells like farts.
That's your professional assessment?
Holiday asks over the comm.
Yep. There's a Wagar settlement over the ridge.
His howler wolf pelt kicks in the wind, jingling the little chains that connect it to his armor.
Bunch of red-hunched goggleheads carting distillation gear.
You've scanned the sand? I ask.
Ain't my first slag, boss. I don't like this face-to-face bullshit, but it looks clear.
He glances at his data pad.
Thought Moonies were supposed to be punctual. Pricklicks are 30 minutes late.
Probably cautious. Must think we've air support, I say.
Yeah, because we'd be bloody damn shitbrains for not bringing some.
Roger that,
Holiday says in agreement over the comm.
Why would I need air support when I've got you, I say, gesturing to Severo's grav boots.
A plastic grey case sits on the ground behind him. Inside, a Sarissa missile launcher in foam padding. The same Ragnar used on Cassius's craft. If the need arises, I've got myself a psychotic goblin-sized fighter jet.
Mustang said they'll be here, I say.
Mustang said they'll be here.
Several mocks in childish voice.
They better. Fleet can't squat for long out there without being spotted.
My fleet waits with Orion in orbit since Mustang took her shuttle to Nessus, the capital of Io.
50 torch ships and destroyers hunkered down, shields off, engines dark, on the barren moon of Sinope, as the larger fleets of the Golds swim through space closer in to the Galilean moons. Any closer, and the gold sensors will pick us up. But as it hides, my fleet is vulnerable. With one pass, a measly squadron of ripwings could destroy it.
The Moonies will come, I say.
But I'm not sure of it. They're a cold, proud, insular people, these Jovian golds. Roughly 8,000 peerless scarred call the Galilean moons of Jupiter home. Their institutes are all out here, and it is only societal service, or vacations for the wealthiest among them, that takes them to the core. Luna might be the ancestral home of their people, but it's alien to most of them. Metropolitan Ganymede is the center of their world.
The Sovereign knows the danger of having an independent rim. She spoke to me of the difficulty of imposing her power across 1 billion kilometers of empire.
Her true fear was never Augustus and Bellona destroying one another. It was the chance that the Rim would rebel and cut the society in half. 60 years ago, at the beginning of her reign, she had the Ash Lord nuke Saturn's moon Rhea, when its ruler refused to accept her authority. That example held for 60 years. But 9 days after my triumph, The children of the Moon Lords, who are kept on Luna in the Sovereign's Court as insurance towards their parents' political cooperation, escaped. They were assisted by Mustang's spies, which he left behind in the Citadel. 2 days after that, the heirs of the fallen Arch-Governor Rivas Aura, who was killed at my triumph, stole or destroyed the entirety of the Societal Garrison Fleet in its dock at Callisto. They declared Io's independence and pressured the other more populous and powerful moons into joining them. Soon after, the infamously charismatic Romulus Aura was elected sovereign of the Rim. Saturn and Uranus joined soon after that, and the second moon rebellion began 60 years, 211 days after the first. The Moon Lords obviously expected the Sovereign would find herself mired on Mars for a decade, maybe longer. Add to that a certain low-color insurrection in the core, and one can see why they assumed she would not be able to devote the resources needed to send a fleet of sufficient size, 600 million kilometers, to quash their nascent rebellion. They were wrong. "We've got inbound," Pebble says from her station at the shuttle sensor boards. "Three ships, 290 clicks out."
"Finally," Severa mutters. "Here come the bloody damn Moonies."
Three warships emerge from the heat mirage on the horizon. Two black Sarpedon-class fighters, painted with the four-headed white dragon of Ra, clutching a Jovian thunderbolt in its talons, escort a fat, tan, Priam-class shuttle. The ship lands before us. Dust swirls, and the ramp unfurls from the belly of the craft. Seven lithe forms, taller and lankier than I, walk down into the sand. Golds, all. They wear krill, organic breathing masks made by carvers over nose and mouths. Looks like the shed skin of a locust, legs stretching to either ear. Their tan combat gear is lighter than core armor, and complemented with brightly colored scarves. Long-barreled railguns with personalized ivory stocks are strapped to their backs. Razors hang from their hips. Orange optics cover their eyes, and on their feet are skippers. Lightweight boots that use condensed air instead of gravity to move their user, skipping them over the ground like stones on a lake. Can't get much height, but you can move nearly 60 kilometers an hour. They're about a quarter the weight of my boots, have battery life for a year, and are dead cold on thermal vision. These are assassins, not knights. Holliday recognizes the different breed of danger.
"She's not with them," she says over her comm. "Any telemanesis?"
"No," I say. "Hold, I see her." Mustang steps out of the craft, joining the much taller Ionians. She's dressed like them, except without a rifle. Joined by another Ionian woman, this one with the forward-hunching shoulders of a cheetah, Mustang joins us atop the dune. The rest of the Ionians stay near the ship. Not a threat, just an escort.
"Darrow," Mustang says. "Sorry we're late."
"Where's Romulus?" I ask.
"He's not coming."
"Bullshit,"
Severo hisses.
"I told you, Reap."
"Severo, it's fine," Mustang says.
"This is his sister, Vila."
The tall woman stares down her smashed flat nose at us. Her skin is pale, body adapted for the low gravity. It's hard to see her face past the mask and goggles, but she seems in her early 50s. Her voice is one even note. "I send my brother's greetings and welcome, Darrow of Mars. I am Legate Vila Aura." Sephi slinks around us, examining the alien gold and the strange gear she carries. I like the way people talk when Sephi circles. Seems a little more honest. "Well met, Legatus." I nod cordially. "Will you be speaking for your brother? I'd hoped to make my case in person." The skin to the side of her goggles crinkles. "No one speaks for my brother, not even I. He wishes for you to join him at his private home on the wastes of Carrick.
So you can lure us into a trap?
Several asks.
Better idea. How about you tell your bitch of a brother to honour his bloody dumb agreement before I take that rifle and shove it so far up your fartel you look like a skinny pixie's shish kebab?
Severo, stop, Mustang says. Not here, not these people. Vila watches Sefi circle, taking note of the razor on the huge obsidian's hip.
I could give a shit and piss who this is. She knows who we are. And she ain't got a little trickle going down her leg, standing toe-to-toe with the bloody damn Reaper of Mars. Then she's got less brains than a wad of ass lint.
He cannot come, Vila says.
Understandable, I reply.
Severo makes a grotesque motion.
What is that?
Vila asks, nodding to Sefi.
That is a queen, I say. Sister to Ragnar Valarus.
Vila is wary of Sefi, as well she should be. Ragnar is a name known.
She cannot come either. But I was speaking in regards to that hunk of metal you flew here on. Is it meant to be a ship?
She snorts and turns up her nose. Built on Venus, obviously.
It's borrowed, I say. But if you care to make an exchange...
Vila surprises me with a laugh, before becoming serious once more.
If you wish to present yourself to Moon Lords as a diplomatic party, then you must show respect for my brother, and trust the honour of his hospitality.
I've seen enough men and women set aside honour when it's inconvenient, I say probingly.
In the core, perhaps. This is the rim,
Vila replies.
We remember the ancestors. We remember how iron gold should be. We do not murder guests like that bitch on Luna, or like that jackal on Mars.
Yet, I say.
Vila shrugs.
It is a choice you must make, Reaper. You have 60 seconds to decide.
Vila steps away as I confer with Mustang and Severo. I motion Sefi over.
Thoughts?
Romulus would rather die than kill a guest, Mustang says. I know you don't have any reason to trust these people, but honour actually means something to them. It's not like the Bologna who just tossed the word around. Adhera, Gold's word means as much as his blood.